Hi, I'm Andy Summers, and you're listening to the Rock Solid Podcast.
Make me a deal and make it good for me. I won't get full of myself, I can't afford to be. This is small town music, this is big town music. He's ahead of his time, you know, but he can't use it. If only he could prove it. Well, tomorrow's just a song away, a song away, a song away.
Hey everybody, welcome to Rock Solid, the comedy podcast for all things music, both new and classic. I'm Pat Francis, and joining me today in the Zoom room, this guy wears many hats. He is a photographer, he's an author, he's a composer, he sings a little bit, and you may know him best as the guitarist for The Police. Please welcome Andy Summers. Hello, Andy.
Hi. Nice to hear you.
Nice to hear you too. Andy, where are you currently? Where are we talking to you?
I'm in Los Angeles.
You're in Los Angeles. That's where I'm in Los Angeles also. Oh, okay, yeah. Perfect. We're both enjoying some sunshine today. That's fantastic.
That's not bad. Not bad.
Is Los Angeles your home? Is this where you live full time?
Yeah, I live here, yeah, full time.
And how long has that been?
Oh, quite a few years now. My kids are here, everybody's here. Yes.
So Andy, you have a book coming out, and it's not your first book, but this is a book of I would say fiction.
Yes, it's fiction based on alternate realities.
Gotcha. And the book is called Fretted and Moaning.
Yes.
And it's coming out in August via Rocket 88. And there's many different editions you can buy. You can buy the classic edition. You can get the Fretted and Moaning signature edition, and you can get an ultimate edition. And first, I want to talk about the cover. It's fantastic. Who created this cover artwork?
Yeah, I got lucky there. A local artist, actually called Laura Josephson, a girl I knew some years ago. And I think I sort of commissioned her to do that painting originally for a CD cover.
Okay.
And, you know, I actually had it up on the wall, and for years, I don't know why I never used it for the CD cover. You know, this is going back a few years ago. And then, you know, this project came up, and, you know, the owner of the book company, if you like, was asking me, what do you want to do on the cover? Have you got a photographic? I said, I think I've got the right picture. And he said, well, we might want to use photo. Anyway, I sent him that picture, and of course he freaked out. He said, oh my god, perfect.
Yeah, it's
so that was the end of that. Yeah, so that's the cover.
Yeah, it's fantastic. I mean, the longer you look at the cover photo, I mean, there's stories in this photo. Even it's pretty cool.
Yeah, he's really good. And I was actually happy to meet up with her. She lives not far from me. Weirdly enough, she lived in San Francisco for 10 years, came back, and it was just about the moment she came back that I happened to contact her. Actually, you know what happened was I was in the street, believe it or not, buying an ice cream, and this woman walked past me, dark glasses on, a big sun hat, and then as she went on past me, she said, hi, Andy, and I looked, I was like, God, who's that? Anyway, it was her. So maybe it was meant to be.
Maybe it was meant to be. Well, I love it. It's if you see this cover, you're going to want to buy the book immediately just by looking at the cover.
Yeah, it helps.
So, Andy, you got 45 stories in here. Have you been writing, you know, fiction stories all your life?
I've been writing all my life, pretty much. Yeah, I'm always having to write things, you know, for social media, internet, albums, blah, blah, blah. You know, I mean, I've written much. Well, obviously, I wrote an autobiography.
Sure.
That was made into a movie. And a couple of these stories I had at least 10 years ago, and they were around. I sort of like dipped my toe in the water for fun. I think one like the Cleveland incident that's in there was an early one. And I must have had maybe six or seven of them, and I showed them to a few people, and they went, oh, these are great. Why don't you make it into a book? And I thought, oh, well, maybe I could, you know. Of course, I'm so obsessed with music and making records that taking the time to do that hadn't really occurred to me to step right out. I'd made one big foray with the autobiography, but I got a lot of encouragement, and I read a couple of them, these stories, on stage, and it seemed to be going really well. So that was really the encouragement. And I think this is about maybe 2 years ago now that I really got down to it. And you know, I mean, the whole writing process, of course, I had a lot of notes, a lot of ideas. Sure. But I had to sort of get to it and really develop them as, you know, stories,
well,
which I did.
You mentioned the Cleveland incident, and that that story, that's just a one-pager, and it closes out with the band, the bar band, breaking into Dead End Job. So is this one of these stories
that's close to, the truth. Very early days with the police, you know, and I think it was Cleveland or Detroit or somewhere, like, it's kind of a tough call.
But yeah,
we felt, you know, coming from England with dyed blonde hair, punk regalia and all that, it didn't really fit in with this scene in the Midwest at all, you know, as I sort of mentioned in the story.
Sure. It says stuff like lots of U.S. flags up in the place. Looks like we're going to have to drop some of the songs from the set list and whatnot. Yeah. But yeah, that was the one that I read where I'm like, this seems to be the most based in reality of all of them. But you're a great writer. I mean, you don't need me to tell you that. The story Girls with Guitars, I really feel like you captured the voices of the girls in that story, Alice and Naomi. Like, I really felt like I was reading actual dialogue that girls that age would say. So bravo.
Yeah. Well, yeah. I mean, obviously, you know, I've had a life of doing this and being out there and playing,
sure,
and being around people and fans and all the people that you get involved with. And I guess to some extent, you know, I drew on memories and impressions that I've been through over and over, you know, touring around America, you know, starting in little clubs and working up to stadiums over the years, you know, all over the world. So I guess, you know, although I hadn't put it to paper, I was sort of full of it, you know, once I sort of like tapped into it, you know, I was able to, oh yeah, I remember something. Ooh, make a note of that. And, you know, gradually I sort of built a list of ideas and notes that, course, then had to be developed, but that's when you get down to it and see if you've got it in you to do it.
Also, you have children, I believe.
Yeah.
So you know how kids talk. I mean, as all dads do. So you probably incorporate a little of that here and there when you need it.
Yes.
Just draw on all the experiences you can. What I like about the book is it's this is a compliment. It's easy to read. It's easy to burn through these stories. Like, you can pick it up and drop in anywhere and just have fun with it. So I've been enjoying it. The PR person sent me a PDF of it, so I've been going through it, and it's so much fun. It's like, it's perfect summer reading, if I can say that. If that makes sense.
Fair enough. And, you know, when I started into this, definitely, you know, my instruction to myself was that, you know, this is, you know, really, it's like comedy.
Mm-hmm.
Dark comedy, because most of these have got sort of like twisted endings or sort of slightly tragic, ironic, we would say in England, ironic endings. That's my sense of humor that, you know, and I thought, well, I could write a book where, you know, if you like, the central character in each story is a guitar, or not necessarily the central character, but it is in each story, and somehow the various people in the stories' lives somewhat revolve around a guitar somehow or the other. So I didn't want to start with some like really heavy, dense, you know, like, well, even pretentious book. I wanted to do something that was fairly accessible. But even that, to do that and to do it well, takes skill. I mean, if you read somebody like David Sedaris, these light sort of comic favorites, there's a great deal of skill goes into making them read so easily.
Right,
you know,
exactly.
Enjoyable. It's difficult to do. But I certainly wanted to strike a tone like that so that, you know, I'm not going to start off writing about, I don't know, chemistry.
Right. And I do like that the through line is chiefly guitarist, which is obviously something you know about. So that's cool. How do you see yourself? Like, if I ask you, do you feel like, are you a writer? Are you a guitarist? Are you a photographer? How would you like to be remembered most?
I'm definitely a guitarist, but, you know, I seem to have enough within me to reach out to other things. Like, you know, I think I'm a pretty cultured person, but, mm-hmm. you know, I've always been a complete movie addict and book addict. So I do like stories and narrative. You know, and you, as you go through life, I think you find that these are the kind of things I like. And so, And I would say this actually to a young musician, you know, okay, you're going to play your instrument, but you know, you should take in a lot of other things like literature and great art house films and let that seep into your musical work, because it's going to help you. It's going to broaden you and make you more interesting as a player. You know, my first and foremost talent was music, you know, and that's when I was 11. In fact, I started piano lessons at six. So music was my expression. And this is something I usually like to say when talking about these kind of things, is that I think what I'm looking for in any form, if you know, I've done a lot of photography, a lot of influences there, and writing, and the condition that I'm looking for in these other mediums, if you like, is the condition of music. Sometimes you get to a place where I think it's singing back to me, and I go, I think we're getting there now. So that's what's in my head, and
right,
that's the way I go for it, yeah.
That's the thing about the Police. I don't want to use the word intellectual, but the three of you always came across as intelligent. You know, you weren't, you know, a lot of rock bands, you know, they just know how to do that, and that's what they do. But you guys, always.
We were a little bit different in that respect.
Yeah, you always seemed like there was a little bit more going on there behind the scenes, other than just, you know, a three-piece rock band. So, and I always appreciated that. So I do want to talk about, you do your photography book, I'll Be Watching You, Inside the Police, 1980 to 1983. Yeah. Did photography happen before you were on tour with the band? Have you always been a photographer?
No, it's interesting. You know, of course, like anybody in life, generally, I had cameras and took pictures, but I hadn't like sort of grasped it like, hey, you know, this is a medium that I'd really like to express myself in. It came about very early days in the Police. I think we were in New York, and I was, maybe the way it happened, surrounded by photographers with incredible equipment. You know, it always seemed to be women photographers, with Nikons and Minoltas and bags full of gear, and look this way, look that way, do this, pose like this. You know, I got kind of involved in the photography, and I said, you know, man, I got to get a really good camera. So one of the women photographers took me out, and I ended up buying a Nikon and a nice lens, and that was it. And then I just started, you know, looking at a lot of photography, and I guess at the beginning just trying to emulate it, take pictures. And, you know, I didn't have a lot of clue, but I must have, you know, my visual sense started to wake up. And, of course, I was surrounded by sort of remarkable events all the time.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Yeah. It was kind of incredible. So I started to, you know, I don't think I used the word to myself document, but what I was doing was really shooting a kind of document of my own life, which was all those crazy years that I passed through with the Police. I photographed everything, you know.
And how much of great photography, how much of it is luck? Because I mean, you're grabbing that image in an instant. I mean,
yeah,
you know, a second later, that's gone.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, there's a certain amount of luck. I mean, there's all kinds of styles of photography. You know, I mean, Cartier-Bresson coined the phrase, the decisive moment. In other words, it's like out on the street and you suddenly grab it and you got it. But you know, that takes a lot of, visual acuity, a lot of self-training, so that you recognize, you know, somebody throwing a shape or something on the street, and you go, bam, you got it. But you got to be prepared. And that takes, you know, you train yourself to see like that. You know, if you're going to shoot like an action or an interaction between people on a street, or whether you're seeing sunlight on the edge of a building or a silhouette at night or something like that, you know, you start to get a visual vocabulary of your own. Partly you pick it up from studying other photographers, photography, painting, and acquiring a visual vocabulary. And then you learn to, I mean, you know, for me, it's great fun to just go, oh, I've never been in the city, but I'm just going to walk around with a camera.
Right, yeah.
And what I can get, you know, and I completely enjoy it. I've never gotten bored with it. I'm still doing it.
And so you'll still take a camera out with like a real camera, like not your phone. I feel like maybe.
I'll use a Leica. Now I use a Leica M10 with three or four lenses, you know, high end, very beautiful, incredible digital camera with, you know, Summicron, Simulux lenses. That's, yeah,
I feel like since everyone has a camera on their phone now, that it's, and everyone's taking pictures of everything all the time, that it's a kind of a lost art, but those who still do it with a camera, that's the real deal. And you can tell.
It is. I mean, yeah, of course I've gone out, you know, and I've got an iPhone and it's got iPhone 11 camera.
Sure.
And it's a huge competitor to the, and very threatening to all the camera companies because everybody's got an iPhone. It's incredible what's happened. But no, it's not the same. The iPhone is not the same as using a high-end Summicron lens. It's not. I much prefer the feel of a camera in my hands and adjusting the lens. You can't do that as well on an iPhone. You can't. I like, you know, I can roll between, you know, 2.8 and f/16. You know, I can adjust the gel. I like, you know, I've done it for a long time. I'm much more comfortable with a real camera if I'm doing real photography. You know, occasionally you'll get one with an iPhone, but I don't think it's at all the same.
I guess a good comparison would be back in the day when you would record an album, everyone would be in the studio playing together. I mean, now if you're recording your part and sending a file to someone else and they're sending a file and then another person's piecing it together, that's not the same as being a band in the studio together.
No, there's, you know, look, making music, I mean, you make it, I mean, the greatest thing about making music generally is making it with other people. And the moment when you really all feel it together and you really play very well together, this is the thrill of being in a band. And, you know, you have great nights, nights that are not so good, but when it's really there and you really connect and the chemistry falls into place, it's absolutely thrilling. Yeah, I mean, I have done some stuff quite recently, you know, where people send me their tracks, mm-hmm. I play on them and send it back. And, you know, I have to sort of, okay, it's guitar solo time. Let me just work myself up into a frenzy here. Put something down like you're standing there. Yeah, of course, mod musicians, we can all do that now. You know, we can do it over the wires, if you like. But no, I'm a big believer in, you know, really live playing. Probably a lot of the records I prefer to listen to are made in 2 or 3 days with the band all just in the, you know, in the studio together, getting a good take.
Yeah. And you would know, because by my count, you're on well over 40 or 50 studio albums. I mean, with all the different projects, yeah. It's just incredible. How long did it take to make Outlandish Day Amor?
Well, that's, you know, oddly enough, that's the sort of anomaly in our record making process, because we had no money at the time. We were barely surviving. And the only way we could record was, yeah, we're back in London. There was a studio in just outside of London, a place called Leatherhead. And they would sort of let us in on Sunday afternoons to have a go for a few hours. So I think it actually literally took us 6 months of sort of Sunday afternoon, not every Sunday afternoon,
gotcha.
But when we could get in. And we started with one set of material, which was pretty rough, and then threw it out and then got another piece in. And that album was sort of pieced together until we had the whole thing in place and felt, okay, we can sign off on this. Not that anybody at all was interested in us, because we were completely unknown. The one thing that put it on the map, of course, ultimately was the release of Roxanne.
Days are over. You don't have to show your body to the night.
And it didn't make us at that time, but it was noted. Oh, wait a minute, these guys, we might want to watch out for them. The other albums were all made very quickly. I think the second album was made in 10 days.
Wow.
Because by that time, we'd sort of made it. We were a hot item.
Right, exactly.
We were gigging every night. So we went in the studio. It was like the three of us all playing together, and we were completely into our band thing. The others were pretty much like that. We never sort of really labored over it. We didn't take years to make a record.
I want to point out on the first album, the song, it's not really a song. It's a spoken word, Sally. Yeah.
I was blue and lonely. I couldn't sleep a wink. And I could only get unconscious if I'd had too much to drink. There was somehow something wrong somewhere. And each day seemed grey and dead. The seeds of desperation were growing in me head. I needed inspiration, a brand new start in life, somewhere to place affection, but I didn't want a wife. And then by lucky chance I saw, in a special magazine, an ad that was unusual, the like I'd never seen. Experience something different with our new imported toy. She's loving, warm, inflatable, and a guarantee of joy. She came all wrapped in cardboard, all pink and shriveled down. A breath of air was all she needed to make her lose that frown. I took her to the bedroom and pumped her with some life. And later, in a moment, that girl became my wife.
That almost feels like that could have been a story that you could plop into this book,
yeah.
Fretted and Moaning, because yeah, so that was so fun. And when that album came out, I think I was in eighth grade. So hearing that was quite eye opening, because I'm like, what is he? I might not have even known what you were talking about.
Yeah,
at that young age.
Well, I think you get it now. But of course, yeah, if you like, that was an early effort, and it sort of somehow seemed to fit in with the punk ethos. I think when we did it on stage, and I'd come out and do that, and it would give Sting a break from his singing throat for a few minutes. And we'd get a blow-up doll and bring it onto the stage and probably smash it with our guitars. Yeah.
That was your Alice Cooper moment.
That kind of thing. Yeah, but everybody liked it. And believe me, the blow-up dolls in those days were pretty ugly.
One of the first songs also from the band that you co-wrote with Stuart and Sting, which is, yeah, it's such a killer, is Dead End Job. Love it, yeah, so much. And that was just a single, right? That was like a double, yeah, A-side single you guys did. And just great. You guys are just tearing it up.
Very early days, very, very much buried in the very overwhelming punk atmosphere in London at the time, which faded eventually. But that was like trying to be part of what was going on in London then.
Yeah.
Eventually we saw naturally transcended it musically and went to sort of a different place as we found our own signature, if you like.
Yeah, I can't think of many bands that in a short time span of just five studio albums changed their own landscape, from your first album to Synchronicity. You guys were just, it was like you guys are surfing and you're on top of the wave the entire, yeah, five albums.
Yeah.
When I talk with my friends about music and we talk about a band that has a perfect catalog, the police always comes up because I don't think there's one clunker in the bunch, song wise. I mean, every single song on every single album, I love it. Yeah. So you guys nailed it. Zenyatta Mandata, 1980, Behind My Camel, an instrumental written by Andy Summers, wins a Grammy Award. That was one your bandmates didn't take to immediately, I'm being
a funny
nice.
Story. Yeah, I mean, you know, I don't know what kind of moodiness might have been going on between us. It was a strange record because we was, you know, for, I think, tax purposes, we were sent to Holland to record this album. We got 1 month in this studio. And then in the middle of it, our manager dragged us out of us and made us go back to England and Ireland for a week, which, you know, we were in the middle of trying to make an album. It was completely insane. But, you know, we headlined these two massive, you know, many untold thousands of people turned up. Then went back to finish it off. But, Behind My Camel was in there, and I proposed it because I was into this sort of weird instrumental music. Sting didn't want to do it. And Stuart was willing to play on it. And I think what happened was I did it with Stuart, and then Sting took the tape and buried it in the garden under a tree. Or something. He did some weird thing like that. So there was just like a little bit of interplay. We found the tape, obviously. And, lo and behold, it won the Grammy for the best instrumental.
Now, when you win a Grammy then for it, do you give it back to Sting a little bit? You know what I'm saying? I know that you guys...
Yeah, I'll probably, yeah, that's sort of waved it in his face. Yeah.
Now, and who gets the Grammy? Do you just get it?
I got it. Yeah.
You just get it because you wrote it and performed it.
That's my memory. Yeah. I have it at home. Yeah.
All right. So the band doesn't get a Grammy just because it's on a police album. Andy Summers gets a Grammy.
Yeah. Yeah.
No, congratulations, Andy.
I've got a few other ones, nominations too, along those lines.
The Police have some great B-sides too, some quirky things, and you are a part of a lot of these, including Friends, written and sung by you from there's a B-side for Da Do 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 Da 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 Da.
I like to eat my friends and make no bones about it. I like to eat my friends, I couldn't do without it. Ain't a man or a poet friend. I know just how you'll taste. Your limbs go sliding down my throat and never go to waste. Your death of ghosts will sadden me until I drop your essence. I know your life was not in vain when digestion is commencing. Consider this a celebration and the deepest pack of friends. I hope that you will dine on me when I come to an end.
You have, what do I want to say? You do have a darker, quirky sense of humor for sure.
Well, yes. And, you know, I think, I'm trying to think of the name of the book, A Stranger in a Strange Land, I think was the book I was reading at the time. And somehow it influenced me to write that song. And I think possibly another spur to whatever I was going to write had to be very in sort of direct contrast to what Sting might write.
Right.
Otherwise we'd be competing in the same place. So, you know, I mean, at least I had enough savvy to do that, you know.
And is a song like Friends, is that presented to Sting for him to sing, or did you know you would sing that one?
I didn't think he'd sing it, I'm sure. I think I'd seen the light by then.
Ghost in the Machine, 1981. It's coming up on its 40th anniversary in October. That's incredible. That's the first time I got to see you guys in concert. I believe it was at the Pittsburgh Civic Arena, and Bow Wow Wow was your opening act. It was an amazing show. But now you have a song on that album that's fantastic that you wrote alone and that Sting did sing, Omega Man. It's fantastic.
Yes, well, that's a bit controversial because I did write that one, and Sting did sing it. And, well, it's got a slightly unpleasant history because that was supposed to be the first single off that album, but I think it was a very upsetting proposition to Sting, so it didn't actually happen. Mm-hmm. But that's what A&M wanted to put out as the first single.
It's funny because when I hear stories about things like this, when you think of what the singles were, they seem like they were the perfect choices. Now, had Omega Man been released as the first single, I would probably be saying that was the perfect choice.
It would have been a number one.
Yeah, yeah.
It's a very cute video that I don't know how I saw this, but there's somewhere on YouTube, there's a young girl, she looks about 16 or 17, and she mimes all of Omega Man. She's sitting there with a guitar. She's sort of miming the singing and playing the guitar. It's very cool. She plays the guitar solo, everything. Really cute. Really pleased by seeing that.
Seeing these videos of kids on YouTube, I'm assuming kids were doing this all the time, but now we get to see it too. And it's quite impressive, the talent and fun that's out there.
It's amazing.
Your guitar work on Omega Man, I mean, I don't play an instrument, Andy, but it's so impressive to my ears. I really never hear anything quite like your guitar playing. When did you tap into your unique sound, or what technique are you using on a song like Omega Man?
Well, you know, I've got, might I say, dare I say, pretty good technical chops. You know, I'm a pretty fluent player. I think one way I look at this is that I think all of us in the Police, we were so lucky to meet each other, because I think somehow the three of us playing together brought out these abilities, you know, or this taste to play this way. And I think if we played, we'd all been in other bands, we may not have ever reached this point, but this is what we did together. You know, for my case, I can tell you very specifically, you know, I was pretty, you know, I'd been to college in California. I'd you know, played classical guitar for years. And, you know, I was a pretty trained musician and played with orchestras, everything. Now I was in this rock trio. So, what's the point I was going to make?
We were talking about your technique and your sound and your style.
Yeah, so you know, I was a pretty full on player by the time we got to the thing. Oh, I know I was going to say, but you know what was so fortunate that as with me and Sting, you know, the two harmonic players, mm-hmm. Sting's background taste wise was very similar to mine. You know, we'd sort of grown up with all the same kind of music, including, you know, Thelonious Monk, Miles Davis, Sonny Rollins, Rolling Stones, Beatles, blues, Brazilian music. It was almost a parallel two parallel universes that came together. Well, that doesn't even make sense. But you know,
I know what you're saying. I know what you're saying.
You get my drift. Yeah, I'm not expressing it well, but so. But with the given that we were a rock trio, and so whatever influences we had to bring into some kind of pop song, rock song format, and be able to go out there and play them with, you know, aggression and, you know, sound like a rock band. But there was a lot of other information coming in that maybe, you know, if you were a punk band in London in 1977, you weren't going to have that information. But Sting, you know, he came from a jazz fusion group, actually.
Yep.
And I'd done all this stuff already. So, you know, and then Stuart somehow sat somewhere in the middle. And then was a, another thing that worked very well for us, and particularly for Sting, was reggae. We weren't a reggae band at all, but we were able to adopt, in particular Sting's case, the sort of loping reggae rhythm on the bass lines, so that it gave him more opportunity and less difficulty in singing out over the bass lines instead of, you know, hammering out 16th notes all the time. So,
and sometimes when white guys lean into reggae, it's not accepted for, you know, it doesn't seem authentic, but you guys were able to do it, and it was and get it out to the masses, and we accepted it. We loved it.
Well, the songwriting was really good. Oh, well, we were good at it. No, we're a very good band.
Look, I like that you're saying, I like that you know that you guys were a good band. I mean, you're humble, but also, you know, yeah, or else I wouldn't be talking to you 40 years after Ghost in the Machine was released.
Yeah, no, we were really good. It's one of those unique things. I mean, I just think we're all so lucky to have met one another. Yeah. And of course, the band changed all our lives forever.
Now, when I would see you live, Stuart is one of the greatest live drummers I've ever seen, and in the studio too. But when you guys are playing live, I'm just watching Stuart. He's all over the place on the kit. Now, with you, you have to listen because you can't believe all the sound that's coming out of Andy Summers' guitar. Like, you're the only guitar player on that stage, and for lack of a better word, you are making quite a beautiful racket on that stage. It's just, it's incredible.
Well, I think that, you know, as we start as a trio, and, you know, there are other rock punk trios around, and it's always, you know, like, you know, the wall of noise, you know, very heavy, you know. And, you know, my sensibilities maybe are a bit more delicate or elegant than that, but, you know, I'm playing rock guitar. I felt that over the course of a 1.5 hour, 2 hour set on stage, I needed to vary the sound a lot, you know, color it a lot. And this was right at the beginning of, you know, when guitar players was just starting to really get into pedals and effects. We'd gone from, like, you know, just a single reverb on the amp or vibrato. This was early stuff with, like, Fender amps, to, like, now we suddenly had something called a Phase 90 pedal, and then came an electronic wah-wah. And slowly these things started to come along, and I started to incorporate them. And I, not too far into it, I was able to have built a, you know, special pedal board where, you know, I'd really utilize it so that, you know, the color of the guitar throughout the show, you know, would just keep changing, you know.
And it did.
It's very experimental.
Let me ask you about after Behind My Camel wasn't accepted with open arms by the other other guys in the band. Were you hesitant about presenting material after that, or did the Grammy give you some confidence to?
Well, that's a good question, but no. I mean, I didn't. No, I didn't have any humility in that sense. I thought I had the best songs, actually.
Well, good. You have to. That's how you have to enter it. You have to. Everyone has to feel like they have the best songs.
No, I don't think anyone had that was above me musically. I think I was, you know, this is why it's so unique. You know, it's hard to take apart. You know, people say, oh, well, we could have done that. I remember other musicians going, oh, we could have done that. I go, no, you couldn't.
No.
You couldn't. No, you couldn't copy that. You can't. It's completely unique, and it's never going to be. You know, there's never going to be another band like it.
No.
That's it.
If everyone could do it, we would have heard it already.
Well, we got copied a lot, obviously.
Well,
I think we changed the lexicon of rock.
Yeah, we'll call it. You influenced people is how we'll say it. If we're being kind. Yeah, and again, a bunch of other cool songs during the Ghost in the Machine sessions, like am I saying that right? Is it Shambell? Is that how I say it?
Shambell, that was another instrumental that I recorded.
Yeah. Excellent song. I love that. And you know what's funny, Andy? I'm not a big instrumental guy. I always like lyrics because then I can sing along to it. But your instrumentals, these grab me. Like those two albums that you made with Robert Fripp.
Yeah.
I Advance Mass and Bewitched. Those are so much fun to listen to. They're just so great.
They were fun to make. We had a good time doing it. And actually, just so your listeners know, those are being re-released later this year, I think after the summer, as a box set.
Fantastic.
With notes, and maybe there might even be a couple of extra tracks. So that's coming out again.
Good to know, because those are hard to find. Like, you have to, if you don't own them, if you didn't get them when they were first out, you're paying top dollar on eBay. So yeah, let's give the money back to Andy and Robert.
Yeah, they were pretty influential albums. I mean, the I Advance Mass got into the top 60 on Billboard, which for a quirky instrumental album was pretty impressive.
And, well, I mean, the pedigree of you and Fripp, I mean, that brings out the hardcore fans for sure who want to hear what you guys do together.
Yeah.
Let's move on to Synchronicity. Mm. So, the song Mother. When I first picked up Synchronicity, that was not a song that I enjoyed that much, if I'm being honest
well,
with
two
you.
Well, there's Synchronicities. Which one? The first one or the second one?
No, I'm talking about the song Mother.
Oh, Mother.
Yes.
Oh, yeah.
So
yeah, well,
when I first heard that, it was not a song that I enjoyed that much. But I have to...
It's weird. It's not supposed to be enjoyable,
right.
Really.
But I have
it's
to tell you...
artifacts in the middle of the album.
But I have to tell you, and it's funny too, the placement of it, it's like boom, right here in the middle. Like you guys didn't tuck it at the end of a side. You guys, boom, right there, track four.
Yeah.
Now, as I've gotten older and my musical tastes have changed and my sense of humor has changed and all those things change, now I love the song. I love it. It's so much. It's just frenetic. It's I don't know how to describe it. There's nothing else like that song in the Police catalog.
No. I mean, I think I came up with that again, you know, like there's no point in competing with Sting, but actually, Sting loved it too. And
yeah.
Let's put that on the album. Of course, it absolutely freaked out A&M.
Of course.
We were huge by that time. And every track's supposed to be like a popular song written. And I've got this song that's more like Captain Beefheart.
Right.
And it's really weird. It's just very clever because it's written in 7/4. It's got that really quirky, weird, but difficult to do guitar solo and me doing the vocals. So, you know. This is not a simplistic, stupid pop song. It's quite complex and quite difficult to pull off, but it's there. I think it's pretty good, actually.
Yeah, yeah, I think it is too.
Everybody wrote about it because it was so off the wall for a band like us with that kind of profile at that time that everybody mentioned it. It sort of worked in the opposite way. Not like, oh, I'm never going to listen to that band again. In fact, it got us a lot of notice.
I have no idea how Murder by Numbers didn't make it onto the original vinyl album. I think it was relegated to the cassette and the CD.
Yeah.
I mean, if we're going to call it a B-side, even though it is on the CD, that might be one of my favorite B-sides of all time. I mean, that song is amazing.
Once that you've decided on a killing, first you make a stone of your heart, and if you find that your hands are still willing, then you can turn a murder into art. There really isn't any need for bloodshed, you just do it with a little more finesse. If you can slip a tablet into someone's coffin, and it avoids an awful lot of mess.
How did it not make it?
I wrote the riff. I had the whole chords and that riff. I had the whole thing.
Yeah.
And I would be playing it on my own in the studio, noodling, and Sting finally sort of wondered, that's good, that's really good. I might have something that could go over that. Anyway, he looked in his big lyric Bible and he pulled out a lyric. And that's what we got.
And you put it together and you and Sting.
And I think, it was a record company that, you know, I think they were Murder by Numbers. Oh, we can't possibly put that on this band's album. And so it didn't make it onto the album. Of course, it's been subsequently on all kinds of releases. It's known.
Yeah.
It's fun to play, actually, because it's in 6/8 and it's got these really cool chords that, you know, most bands wouldn't play. So, we did it a lot in concert.
Yeah, I think a lot of people might think that it was on the original release, even though it wasn't, because it's that well known among Police fans for sure.
Yeah.
Someone to Talk To. There's a B-side written and sung by Andy. You wanted Sting to sing this one. He wouldn't.
Yeah, I can't remember quite what happened. I have one major journalist friend who says, God, Someone to Talk To. Man, that should have been a major hit, Police. Yeah. It's sort of... slightly beneath the covers, that one.
Yeah.
Never came out like it should have done.
Though it's me that's on fire, not this cigarette. I was stabbed in the back by that young suffragette. And what do I care if she leaves me alone? If I need somebody, I'll pick up the phone. I'll put on my good face, clean up the flat. I'm starting all over, goodbye to all that. I'll put on some music and pour out a drink. Back to bed and I'll try not to think. Someone to talk to, to talk to. 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 She was a person I just couldn't see, and I tried to make her what she could be.
And then another great B-side that you co-wrote with Sting is Once Upon a Dream.
Oh, yeah, Once Upon a Daydream or something. Yeah.
Once Upon a Daydream, yes. Thank you for correcting me.
I haven't heard that in quite a long time. I can't remember how it goes, actually. Yeah, I know that we were quite pleased with that when we did it. It sort of came out of nowhere, and suddenly we had this other piece, you know, yeah.
Once upon a daydream,
I'm
sitting in love. Once upon a lifetime, I know it must be true. When the months had told us I'd have to marry you. Once upon a daydream doesn't happen anymore. Once upon Daddy found out.
Okay, I just have a couple more questions, Andy, and then I'm going to let you go enjoy the California sun.
Yeah.
I want people to make sure that you go in August. You can go order it right now.
You can order it now. It's available for pre-order on andysummersbook.com. andysummers.com.
That's right, andysummersbook.com. And your website is andysummers.com. Twitter is asummersmusic. And Instagram is at andysummers_official. So take note of all those. But number one, andysummersbook.com. Once you go there and you just see the cover, you're going to love it. And you've already heard from me that what I've read is really fun. And it needs to be read just like Andy's music needs to be listened to. And I'm so excited that I, Advanced Mask and Bewitched are going to get re-released. Yeah. Every Breath You Take, the singles, you guys re-record Don't Stand So Close to Me. That was released. I think you re-recorded Da Do 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 Da 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 also.
We definitely did Don't Stand So Close to Me.
Yeah, because that was released. Was the plan really to record like all the hits over again?
No.
All right, that's just a myth.
You know, there was a very weird moment. You know, the authorities got us back together like a year after we'd broken up or something like that. We're all in London. And, you know, to do something, I don't even know why we did it, but I know we recorded up in Swiss Cottage in London, and Sting didn't want to write a new song, so we tried to do another version of Don't Stand So Close to Me. But the whole thing got completely ruined because Stuart went out on a horse to play polo, fell off the horse, broke his collarbone, couldn't play the drums. That was the end of it. And I think we did something with a drum machine,
yeah.
They were all like, everyone was hanging out. Are they going to get back together?
That's always what people say. That's always what people talk about. So,
the truth was, it was kind of a sad, moment because, Stuart fell off a horse, Otherwise, the band may have gone back out. Who knows? But it didn't happen. So
let me ask you this. 14 years ago, you guys did the reunion tour. Was that enough to satisfy all the members in the band? Was that enough to put it?
It was kind of an incredible tour. It was the biggest tour of all time. It's right up there, it's a complete stadium tour. It was great. I thought the best we'd ever played. None of us has ever stopped playing. Made many records. I thought it was a fantastic playing a musical tour. And of course, the technology was so great by then. So we benefited on everything. It's almost like it'd be impossible to repeat that. State of the art tour. It was fantastic.
Yeah, I was there at Dodger Stadium. What I loved about it is, sometimes when a band hasn't been together for this long and they go back out on a big tour, they want to augment the band with horns and singers and keyboard and all this stuff. And you guys kept it as stripped down as you possibly could. And yeah, I appreciated that.
That's kind of a definite thing. And I didn't want all that. I hate it.
Yeah.
I want it to be guitar out front. I don't want to hear horns or any keyboard. Or anything. The real sound of the Police is a trio. And, you know, I mean, God bless Sting for at least agreeing to that. I mean,
yeah.
No, I thought we played great. And yeah.
Yeah. Because I think the worry amongst Police fans were, is Sting going to want to do the songs the way he interprets them? So, you know, as a solo artist. And thankfully that wasn't the case.
No, he didn't.
He saw the value.
Right early on, there was a little bit of movement towards that, but it was just rubbish. You
right.
know, like, no, don't do that, man. Just, you know, you can't change message in a bottle into a fucking bottom over. Let's do it the way it is. Everybody be thrilled.
Exactly. And that, that tour is you can get the live album certifiable, which is a great live album, a great DVD too. If you weren't lucky enough to be there like me, that's the best way to check it out. 1987 XYZ, Andy, they convince you to record a solo album and sing. Were you nervous about being out front for that many songs?
I did it. You know, I don't know. At that moment, it was a strange time. I said my head was probably not really attached to my body. It was kind of a weird time. And yeah, I did do that album, and I thought it was a pretty good album.
It is a good album.
And I did go out with it, and I sang all the songs. And I don't know, somewhere in there, I thought, I'm not sure if this is for me to be the singer out front and do this. So I didn't.
You never did it again.
Direction. I made, you know, I joined up with another label and made what's it called, Mysterious Barricades. Yeah.
And let the guitar do the singing. All right. Let's. I do want to tell people Andy has a great documentary called "Can't Stand Losing You: Surviving the Police," based on your memoir "One Train Later." Loosely.
Yes, exactly.
And there's a great scene in there where you're, I forget what country you're in, but there's a karaoke bar and they're singing a Police song and you go in. I can't imagine. I saw the documentary, but if you were actually there and you were singing a song by your favorite band and one of the members walked in, my head would explode.
A totally freaky moment. And I can give you, I was, the film director was in Japan with us. And I said, let's go down to area in Tokyo called Shinjuku. And within that area in Shinjuku, there's this tiny area called the Golden Guy. And it's this little labyrinth of streets. It's really amazing. It's one of my favorite places in the world. I've been there a few times and done a lot of photography in there. Anyway, so the film crew was following me around. And it was about to snow. It was like January or February. And we're wandering around about midnight. And so we said, all right, well, that's it. You know, there's Andy wandering through the Golden Guy. And as we were coming out, going back to either the cars to take us back to the hotel or whatever, and we started to hear Every Breath You Take. This is incredible. And the guy's following me with his camera, and we see this tiny little bar, karaoke bar.
Yeah.
And that's where it was, and I said, follow me. And that's the scene you see. I walked in, I had my hat on, my coat.
Yeah.
They're all like drunk and singing Every Breath You Take. And I joined it. I actually gave me the mic, took the hat off, and everybody recognized me. So brilliant, brilliant moment.
Yeah. And it's a real moment. Nothing staged about it, which is what's fantastic.
No, it's wonderful that happened. You can't pray for things like that. It was so spontaneous and wonderful.
All right, everybody. I'm going to thank Andy Summers for giving us this time today. I want you to go to andysummersbook.com and pre-order Fretted and Moaning, 45 short stories that are going to keep you company all year long. Andy, I always ask the artist that I interview to pick one song from their catalog for me to feature as our playout song. I know it's difficult. What one would you like me to play?
You mean a police song?
Anything you want.
Oh, I see.
Yeah, it could be anything that you played on or were a part of or you're proud of.
Well, no, I would opt for Message in a Bottle, I think.
All right. That's a fantastic one. And Andy, thank you so much. I wish you continued success on promoting the book and let's buy this thing, people.
Thank you, Pat.
Thank you so much, Andy. And everyone, please enjoy Message in a Bottle.
Cheers. Bye.